Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, inflation slows, but rising prices force many Americans to go deeper into credit card debt.
The Justice Department appoints a special counsel to investigate classified documents found at President Biden's Delaware home and his former office.
And Iranians protesting the government's oppressive regime refuse to back down, despite the threat of arrest and execution.
For 40 years, we had the fear inside us. Now this is the Islamic Republic, scared of its own teenagers, scared of its own people. So that means this is the tipping point.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Americans received some good news today on inflation. The consumer price index rose 6.5% in December compared with a year ago. That is down from 7.1% in November and marks the sixth consecutive month of falling inflation rates.
But Americans are still feeling the pinch from higher than usual prices, and many have been forced to pull out their credit cards, even while interest rates on those cards are soaring. For a closer look at what all this means, we turn to Michelle Singletary, journalist and author of the syndicated Washington Post column, The Color of Money. Welcome to the NewsHour.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So more Americans are leaning on their credit cards to deal with rising prices, and as interest rates continue to climb, the debt is becoming more expensive. How big of a problem is this, Michelle?
Well, it's a pretty big problem. The Fed is obviously trying to fight inflation, and that has resulted in an increase in credit card rates of up to now 20% on average across the nation. So that means that those folks who are carrying credit card debt from month to month are paying a significant more interest on that debt.
In planning to speak with you, we asked our viewers for their questions about all this. Here's one from Philip Stachelski of California.
Probably my biggest question would be, you know, on debt consolidation and stuff like that. What is the best way to go about it? What is the best way to consolidate that debt? Because it feels like there's so much out there and there's just so little information of what is trustworthy, what could work.
All right. So what are some best practices when it comes to debt consolidation?
So one thing that I recommend is that before you consolidate that debt, make sure that what impacted you having that is gone. So if you're going to still be adding to that, you're just going to sweep all that debt off credit cards. And guess what? People then end up putting more on there. And you also want to make sure that when you consolidate, you're not going to, at the end of the day, pay more. If they stretch it out and the interest rate might seem lower, you actually, at the end, might be paying more on that credit card debt. I would rather you contact your credit card lender and say, I'm having trouble. How can you help me? You know, lots of people don't make that call, and it's understandable. You're thinking, well, I don't have the money. They're not going to help me. But one of the things that credit card lenders tell me is that people don't call to get help, and they will help you.
For folks whose incomes haven't kept pace with inflation, what should they do? I suppose the easy answer is to stop using your credit cards. But for a lot of people, they don't have that luxury.
Yeah, I know that people don't want to hear that, and obviously they're struggling. But if you can, and you've got a lot of debt on your card, you must put it away. That means going back to your budget, cutting everything you possibly can. It may mean changing your where you live, your housing. You know, perhaps you can move in with someone, or someone can move with you, because that's the biggest impact to people's budget is their housing. But the one thing I want you to do is try not to go to payday lenders. You know, don't try to add on to debt in an emergency type situation, because oftentimes that ends up increasing how much you owe. And if, for example, with payday loans, you get one, then your next pay comes, you've got to pay that loan off and you are already in the hole. So again, contact your lenders. You might look into, if your credit is still good, you can see if there is any 0% offers out there that you qualify for, transfer the debt to that, and then take that time to pay it off. Make sure that you can pay it off, though, in that introductory period, which can be anywhere from 15 months, you know, 12 months, 15 months, or 18 months in some cases if you've got really good credit.
So lastly, Michelle, inflation is slowing. Is it enough now for the Fed to pull back on these interest rate hikes?
They've already said that they are going to still probably continue to do the raise. It's slowing, but it's not where they want it to be. So I think the word for 2023 is still inflation is going to be with us. That means cut as much as you can. Look at your budget. And most importantly, if you can, don't charge up and carry that credit card debt because it's going to be so expensive in this next year or two.
Michelle Singletary, thanks so much for your time and for your insights. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Another batch of classified documents from President Biden's time as vice president were found inside his Delaware home, the White House said today. This came after the disclosure earlier this week of documents found inside a Washington office. Today, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the appointment of a special counsel to determine whether anyone broke the law.
The extraordinary circumstances here require the appointment of a special counsel for this matter. This appointment underscores for the public the department's commitment to both independence and accountability in particularly sensitive matters, and to making decisions indisputably guided only by the facts and the law.
For his part, the president and his team believe the documents were simply misplaced and pledged to aid the investigation.
People know I take classified documents and classified material seriously. I also said we're cooperating fully and completely with the Justice Department's review. The Department of Justice was immediately notified, and the lawyers arranged for the Department of Justice to take possession of the document.
Our White House correspondent Laura Barone Lopez is here now to explain this new phase of the investigation. Good to see you, Laura.
Good to be here.
So let's just take a step back, review the timeline, and see how we got here. What exactly was found in Mr. Biden's possession and when?
So Attorney General Merrick Garland actually gave us a whole timeline today. It starts on November 4th, 2022. Archives notified DOJ about documents found at Penn Biden Center office. Then November 9th, 2022, FBI began their assessment. November 14th, 2022, AG Merrick Garland assigned U.S. Attorney John Lausch to investigate. December 20th of last year, Biden's lawyer notified DOJ of additional documents found at his Delaware home. And then January 5th of this year, Lausch briefed Garland and advised that there should be appointment of a special counsel. And then today, January 12th, an additional document was found at President Biden's Delaware home, and they notified the authorities. So that is essentially the full timeline that we have so far around all of these classified documents.
We know Attorney General Merrick Garland has now appointed that special counsel to look into this. Tell us about who that is and what happens now.
Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed Robert Herr. He is a former U.S. attorney from Maryland, and he was appointed by former President Trump in 2017. Garland said today that Herr has supervised a number of DOJ matters relating to national security, public corruption, and other high-profile issues. One key thing here is that I spoke to a former DOJ official, and that person, as well as other experts, have said that this could very well be a faster investigation, even though there are still elements that we don't know, but that because of the fact that it appears more straightforward, given the timeline of how the Biden team and his lawyers returned the documents. The one other thing is that is going to potentially happen, which has not been announced yet, is the damage assessment from the Director of National Intelligence, mm-hmm. which is a common thing that happens in cases when classified documents are found where they're not supposed to be found.
So there is a special counsel also looking into former President Trump's handling of classified documents at his Florida estate of Mar-a-Lago. What is the difference between this probe now?
So we have a number of differences here, right, between the two of them. With President Biden, it was so far a small number of classified documents that appeared to be found. With former President Trump, around 300 classified documents. For President Biden, it was found in his D.C. office and Delaware home. In Trump, it was found in his Mar-a-Lago, Florida estate. And then for President Biden, it was turned over voluntarily and immediately. This is a key difference because for President Trump, as we all know, it was seized by FBI authorities during a search after it had been withheld for more than a year. And that's really big here. When you talk to legal experts, when you talk to former DOJ officials, they say that that criminal difference, the potential for criminal charges is different because former President Trump right now we know is being investigated for potentially violating the Espionage Act for the removal and destruction of records, but especially for the obstruction of justice. And of course, also today, House Republicans have been saying that they are going to investigate President Biden's handling of classified documents alongside this investigation.
Our White House correspondent, Laura Barone Lopez, following it all. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
In the day's other headlines, U.S. air travel returned to close to normal, with 100 flights canceled and 1,700 delayed. A day earlier, travelers were stranded in terminals nationwide after a government computer system broke down. The outage grounded all flights for a time. An investigation is ongoing, but so far, officials are blaming a damaged database file. The mayor of Selma, Alabama, reports significant damage from a large tornado that struck the city this afternoon. The storm blew down trees, whipped debris across roads, and damaged cars and homes. Neighboring counties reported damage as well. There was no word of any deaths or injuries. The U.S. House of Representatives voted today to bar the sale of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to companies linked to China. More than 100 Democrats joined Republicans, saying the ban protects U.S. national security. Opponents said only a tiny percentage of U.S. oil sales to China come from that strategic reserve. The bill's prospects in the Democratic-controlled Senate are unclear. In Ukraine, Russia claimed again that its troops are making grinding gains in the battle for a small eastern town. The area around Soledar is now one of the war's bloodiest battlegrounds. Its fall could leave the city of Bakhmut surrounded, but the Ukrainians insist they're still holding out.
Fighting is fierce in Soledar. The enemy has high losses trying to break through our defense lines. The area outside the city is covered with the bodies of Putin's troops. Nevertheless, the Russians are moving over their own corpses.
If the Russians do capture Soledar, it would mark their most significant battlefield victory in months. Back in this country, federal prosecutors began making their case against former Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio and four lieutenants in the latest January 6th case. The members of the far-right extremist group are on trial for seditious conspiracy. In opening statements, prosecutors said the defendants took aim at the heart of American democracy. Defense lawyers insisted there was no organized conspiracy to interfere with the 2020 election results. Nurses in New York City have reached a tentative deal that ends a three-day strike at two major hospitals. Thousands of nurses walked out on Monday in the Bronx and Manhattan over staffing shortages and patient loads. The tentative contract promises better working conditions and raises totaling 19% over 3 years. And on Wall Street, the December inflation report nudged stocks higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 217 points to close below 34,190. The Nasdaq rose 69 points and the S&P 500 added 13. Still to come on the NewsHour, an infectious disease specialist fights vaccine misinformation in the wake of her husband's death. Why calls for reform have not reduced the number of people killed by police. The first Native American composer to win the Pulitzer Prize discusses his experimental process, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
A growing chorus of Republican lawmakers is calling for New York Congressman George Santos to resign, just days after the scandal-plagued freshman was sworn into the House of Representatives. Santos is under investigation by state and federal authorities after he admitted to lying about key parts of his resume and background. Today, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy stood by Santos, emphasizing that he's now a duly elected member of Congress.
He's got a long way to go to earn trust. But the one thing I do know is you apply the Constitution equal to all Americans. The voters of his district have elected him. He is seated. He is part of the Republican Conference. There are concerns with it, so he will go before ethics. If anything is found to be wrong, he will be held accountable exactly as anybody else in this body would be.
Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman joins us. He's a Republican who shares constituents with George Santos and has called for him to step down. Welcome to the NewsHour. And I want to start with your reaction to what we heard from the House Speaker, that George Santos was elected by the people of New York in his district. He's now a member of Congress, and any issues will be handled by the House Ethics Committee.
Well, I can understand how the Speaker feels, but in my opinion, due process has already been served. George Santos, he basically confessed to everything that was false in his resume. He has said that he did not attend college after he told everybody that he got a degree from Baruch College. He did not work for the financial institution that he said he did. He's not Jewish. That's ridiculous and funny. But one of the things that's most troubling to me is that he would say that his parents were survivors of the Holocaust. That indicates to me that he has no understanding of the gravity of the Holocaust, and he's trivializing it. We have a lot of Jewish residents in Nassau County, probably close to 300,000. Many of them are survivors or family of survivors. These are families that were decimated. These are people that were gassed to death, shot to death, starved to death. And for him to say that his parents went through this when in fact they were living in Brazil, I think is just tragic, and he doesn't understand the gravity of the situation and the gravity of his lies. So he's built a campaign, he's built a life upon lies. And as an elected official, I can no longer trust him. I'm not going to do business with him. I'm not going to deal with him, because how can I have a conversation with him when I don't know whether he's telling me the truth or not? So I've made a decision that enough is enough and he should resign. And I am not going to deal with him so long as he's in elected office.
In speaking with a couple of your Republican colleagues on Long Island, what becomes clear is that nobody really knew who George Santos was before a few years ago. He's a guy who seemingly popped up out of nowhere. And many of his stories, I'm told, never really seemed to connect. Why wasn't he vetted by you and your colleagues, Long Island Republicans, well before Election Day?
Well, Jeff, that's a good question. He was vetted. But certainly we could have done a better job in the Republican Party. But you have to understand, you know, we've had this process for over 40 years, and this is the first time that this has happened. What happens usually is you fill out a disclosure form where they ask you where you work, what school you went to, where you were raised, etc. And you submit a resume and you attend an interview where questions are asked. And obviously he was untruthful in all three steps of the process. But I think what is a more interesting question is, where was the other party? They're supposed to do opposition research. They should have vetted George Santos the same way that each party vets the other side's candidate. So I just don't understand why they weren't able to uncover all of these untruths. But look, we both have egg on our faces, the Republicans and the Democrats. The fact of the matter is, going forward, our chairman, Joe Cairo, said that he's going to tighten the process. They're going to do more digging, and they're going to make sure that people are more properly vetted. And I'm sure the Democrats will do the same.
Well, looking ahead, George Santos has so far been defiant. He says he's not going to resign. In fact, here he is appearing on Steve Bannon's podcast today.
You know, I wish well all of their opinions, but I was elected by 142,000 people. Until those same 142,000 people tell me they don't want me, we'll find out in 2 years.
So if he doesn't resign, and it sounds like he's not going to, then what? Is there any way that he could fulfill his responsibilities as a member of Congress, as you see it?
Well, here's my message to George Santos. I represent virtually everybody in his congressional district. His congressional district is about half the size of Nassau County, and I'm not going to deal with him. We're going to serve the people of the 3rd Congressional District without dealing with George Santos on federal matters. I'm going to put a mechanism in place where we make sure that their voices are heard in Washington, D.C. How can I talk to him about sensitive issues? How can I talk to him about policy? How can I talk to him about constituent complaints where it's completely certain on my part that he has no credibility with me or the community. He's deluding himself if he thinks that he would win re-election based on all of the statements that have made. And he even said that he wouldn't seek re-election. Well, why wouldn't he seek re-election if he thinks everything is okay? He's just deluding himself. He's avoiding the inevitable. And he's really doing a service to the people of the 3rd Congressional District. And he's just staying on the House of Representatives, and he should go.
Bruce Blakeman is the Nassau County Executive. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Jeff.
The anti-regime protests in Iran have been quieter in major cities following an intense crackdown. Protests do continue in northern Kurdish provinces. And across Iran, families are mourning the deaths of their loved ones. Students and activists inside Iran are vowing to continue their resistance and have shared details of brutal abuse and torture with special correspondent Jane Ferguson. To protect their safety, we have disguised their personal features. And just a note, some images and accounts in this story are disturbing.
There are few words to express the pain of a child being killed. Sometimes sounds come closer. Across Iran, families gather to mourn these days at an increasing pace as the regime steps up its crackdown on protesters. Two more young men were hanged at dawn on Saturday. Mohammad Mehdi Karami was 22 years old and a karate champion. Syed Mohammad Hosseini, a children's martial arts coach, was 39. They were hanged for killing members of the security forces. Karami's father also attended Hosseini's burial. Their trials have been described by human rights observers as a sham, confessions forced by torture. Their executions are designed to send a message to other protesters. As news of the hangings made its way to family and friends, they were devastated.
The regime is carrying out a very violent crackdown with executions and lots of arrests. Prisons are full of people. This morning we woke up to the terrible news that they executed two more people. They're trying to stop us from protesting by threatening us with these executions and intense violence.
Several dozen other protesters remain on death row, according to human rights groups. Some 14,000 are believed to have been jailed in the last few months, and over 500 killed by security forces. Despite the recent uptick in killings, and perhaps because of it,
does it increase people's fear?
Iranian-American activists like Masih Alinejad believe the regime is seriously spooked this time.
This is the tactic of the Islamic Republic, create fear within the society that can survive, help Islamic Republic to survive. When I see that people are fearless, when I see that immediately when teenagers getting killed, their parents leading the protest and saying that, I'm not scared of you. For 40 years, we had the fear inside us. Now this is the Islamic Republic, scared of its own teenagers, scared of its own people. So that means this is the tipping point.
The repression, however, is to some extent working. The rising risks of going to protests have caused their numbers to fall.
My friends and I were out protesting at night, and we were arrested. We were tortured, sexually abused, and beaten.
This young woman says she is a Tehran University student. The protests have been less frequent, she admits, as the youngsters are crushed under the weight of Iran's repressive surveillance state.
All of us who go to the protests are being watched by the cameras of the regime. They put cameras in all the street corners and neighborhoods. They come to our front doors. They beat or kidnap us in front of our houses. There are many spies in the cities. They are in every neighborhood. They spy on the houses and the youth especially. And there are some who act like protesters and they join us. But later they share the information with the regime.
The Iranian regime's spies are even in the classrooms of the students, attempting to reach into the minds of the country's young free thinkers.
They used to send some agents to the classes, and suddenly they would start some arguments whether Khomeini was good or bad. And if a student would talk about him, they would make him a lot of trouble. So they have eyes and spies and agents everywhere.
Even when demonstrators are injured by security forces, seeking treatment can be dangerous.
When protesters went to the hospitals, the regime arrested them. One 16-year-old boy died because he was hiding in his home with serious, untreated injuries when the security forces came to arrest him and take him away.
This young man says he is a medic who was living in his Kurdish homelands in the northeast of Iran when the protests erupted there. He got together with colleagues and began treating wounded protesters in secret. Kurdish areas, long resistant to Tehran's rule and pushing for autonomy, have seen some of the most enduring protests, and with them, violent responses.
I tried my best to help them. My friends and I did it together. If we asked for medication or bandages at the main medical centers, we would be arrested, so we had a team delivering them from other, calmer cities. They were confiscating medicines at checkpoints, so we used mountain and village paths. Some people were injured with handguns, shotguns, and AK-47s. Some were shot by sniper bullets. One guy was shot in the chest in Snow City by a sniper. I couldn't save him. He died instantly.
He says eventually, one of the patients he treated was detained and gave up his name.
When I was arrested, they had prepared a written statement. It said that I was the director of a terrorist group that kills people, and they forced me to sign the paper by torturing me for 21 days. They cut me with a knife, hit my back with something heavy, and spilled freezing water on me. They electrically shocked my genitals and burned my body with lighters. Then they threatened my family members. They said they would arrest and kill my younger brother and rape my mother.
He now works to get medical equipment to those who need treatment. As the brutality increases, people like Alinejad are pushing for more of a response from Western governments to isolate Iran diplomatically.
We need is concrete actions. First, I mean, it's not too much to ask that when the regime is killing people, torturing people, 50 people are in the death row, then this is the time. This is the time that the leaders of democratic countries must get united and recall their ambassadors.
Social media has played a huge role in organizing protesters and helping spread word of the demonstrations. In turn, the government has blocked internet access, censored activists from various sites, and prevented news and information about what is really going on from spreading. Members of the regime themselves, however, enjoy full access.
You cannot allow Ibrahim Raisi, Khamenei, the leaders of Islamic Republic, to have Instagram account, Twitter account, Facebook account, verified account, while they are banning 80 million people to use the same social media. I don't get that.
The Iranian regime's executions appear highly calculated, a cruelty doled out slowly as a warning to the resistance. It's an exercise in fear, and either side could still win.
You know, as a young person who lived his entire life here, honestly, I would say we have nothing to lose anymore. We've had enough.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jane Ferguson.
When Buffalo Bills safety Damar Hamlin suffered cardiac arrest during an NFL game last week, a flood of misinformation took over on social media, with anti-vaxxers and conspiracy theorists falsely claiming the COVID vaccine was to blame. The sudden death of sports journalist Grant Wall, who died of an aortic aneurysm while covering the World Cup in Qatar last month, prompted a similar and, again, false narrative. Wall's wife, Dr. Celine Gounder, an infectious disease specialist, is pushing back on this kind of disinformation, and she joins me now. Dr. Gounder, welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks for being with us, and I just have to say how incredibly sorry we all are for your loss. It's only been a few weeks since you lost your husband. My very first question is just, how are you doing?
Thanks, Amna. I feel exhausted. I feel numb. Which has me a bit scared because I know this is going to hit me even harder. But nights are pretty tough. It's sort of when I get a chance to think about it, and it's really hard.
These messages that came up after your husband's passing from total strangers, conspiracy theorists claiming the COVID vaccine was to blame, how and when did you start to see them? And what did you think in that moment?
really as soon as news broke of his death. There were all kinds of rumors, and that ended up emerging as the leading one. And it was also really important to me to find out what had actually happened for myself and for my family, and also to put to rest some of these rumors, lies about my husband's death. And so I worked with the State Department and others to get his remains repatriated as quickly as we could, and then to have an autopsy done as quickly as we could. And all of that happened in the span of just a few days. And then I put out a statement with the results of his autopsy.
Why was it so important for you to do that so quickly, to be as transparent as you were?
Well, honestly, the results have given me some partial sense of closure or comfort in that at least I have an explanation. I think when something like this happens, so often families find themselves asking, why is there something I could have done? And I have continued to ask myself that question. But I also knew that the only way to put to rest these rumors was to get out accurate information, and that the longer that there wasn't an answer, that we didn't know, that those rumors would only get worse.
And did it work? Did putting out the statement and information help in any way?
It did initially. It really did quiet down the disinformation about my husband's death. I had thought we had put it to rest. And then when Damar Hamlin had that in-game cardiac arrest, that really stirred things up all over again, with people asking, you know, why is it these young, healthy people are having, are dying suddenly or almost dying suddenly? And the conspiracy theory that had emerged around that is this idea that COVID vaccines are leading to death. And that's simply not true. We have plenty of data now from vaccination over the last several years, but last few years, that COVID vaccines do not result in an increased risk of non-COVID-related deaths, and of course are preventing COVID-related deaths.
Dr. Gounder, you've been a prominent voice throughout this entire pandemic, offering your insights on the science and the facts behind what we know about the virus and the vaccine. You've talked about this vaccine disinformation playbook, as you call it. Tell me about that. What do you mean?
Well, there are certain strategies that you see, or tactics that are used over and over and over again by these disinformation spreaders. The first is fake experts. So there was a propaganda, anti-vaccine propaganda film that came out this fall that made use of funeral directors and the like to put out disinformation. These are not people who are experts in any way about vaccines, about infectious diseases or immunology. So that's one characteristic. Then you have what are called logical fallacies, which are essentially mental shortcuts that we use when we're bombarded with information. And a great example of this is, if A happens before B, that does not necessarily mean A caused B. And now over 80% of the people in this country have gotten one dose of vaccine. That does not mean that you can attribute all of the deaths that now occur in this country to COVID vaccines. Then you have impossible expectations. So an example of that are the people who said, I'm going to wait until the FDA issues full approval for vaccines, and then I'll know it's safe enough. And then after the full approval was issued, the goalposts moved, and they said, no, I still don't think there's enough data. And finally, you have cherry picking of data. So looking for the data that supports your hypothesis, even though it may not actually be connected or make sense. And then conspiracy theories, or really lies about, you know, one example of this would be microchips and vaccines. That simply is not true. There are no microchips in our vaccines to track people. But these are the characteristics or tactics that you see over and over and over again in this anti-vaxxer playbook.
From an everyday consumer perspective, what can be done to push back against that?
Well, I think people like me, who are experts, need to be putting out good information. I think if you yourself are concerned about why somebody in your family has died, I think an autopsy is a really important tool to help investigate that death. We've seen autopsy rates in the United States drop, Over the past few years, now fewer than 10% of people who die in the United States get an autopsy. And so when people call for an investigation into a death, that's what it means to investigate a death. So I've been a bit confused, by people who are calling for an investigation when that's exactly what we did with medical examiners and forensic scientists. And that's how you get an answer.
Dr. Gounder, you're out here doing the work, continuing to put facts where they are most needed in the hands of people. And you are still mourning your husband, was a legendary soccer journalist, had many fans here in our NewsHour family. I'd like to just ask you what you want people to know about Grant.
Grant was kind, he was generous, he was curious. Anybody from an elementary school student to a young soccer or sports journalist who reached out to him for advice, he was always happy to give them time to talk to them, to grab a coffee. If he was asked for a contact, somebody else was doing a reporting, a story on some other athlete, that Grant knew, Grant was happy to share his Rolodex with people and was very generous. He didn't view that as competition. And I think one major legacy also is the way in which he advanced social justice and human rights through his reporting, whether that was women in sports or LGBTQ rights or recently the rights of migrant workers in Qatar. And I think showing that sports is not just sports, but it's also at this intersection of culture and politics was a big part of what Grant did in his career.
Dr. Celine Gounder, infectious disease specialist joining us tonight. Thank you for your time.
Los Angeles police have released video of the arrest of Kenan Anderson, the cousin of a Black Lives Matter co-founder. He was detained earlier this month and tased after he was involved in a car accident. As he was being arrested, he expressed fears that he would meet the same fate as George Floyd, whose killing by police sparked nationwide protests. Anderson died in police custody several hours later. The incident is still being investigated, but it's a stark reminder of the hundreds of people who die at the hands of police each year and the wide racial disparities that persist among those deaths. John Yang has this report on one mother's experience and where policing in America goes from here.
22-year-old Amir Locke was an aspiring musician and, to his mother, Karen Wells, a loving son.
He had a really good sense of humor. His smile, it was infectious. He loved to give hugs, so that makes me smile.
It was 11 months ago that a police officer shot and killed Locke in a downtown Minneapolis apartment. For Wells, it's been 11 months of devastation.
Mentally, in order for me to get through the day, I basically just tell myself, Amir is on vacation.
Each time Wells returns to Minnesota or learns about another death at the hands of Twin Cities police, the pain of her son's killing comes rushing back.
My heart don't beat the same anymore. It does not beat the same. It's broken. And it'll never, the best surgeon in America can never repair my heart after what they did to my son.
On the morning of February 2nd, Minneapolis police executed a no-knock search warrant on an apartment in connection with a homicide investigation. Locke wasn't named in the warrant and didn't live at the apartment. When officers stormed through the door, he appeared to be asleep on a couch. Locke stirred from under a blanket. He was holding a handgun, which family said he was licensed to carry. An officer fired three shots. The killing touched off days of protest in Minneapolis, still reeling from the death of George Floyd less than 2 years earlier. Adding to the public outrage, initial police accounts wrongly named Locke as a suspect. In the weeks that followed, the city of Minneapolis banned no-knock warrants, but prosecutors did not charge the officer who fired the fatal shots, concluding that he felt threatened.
Amir Locke was holding it by the butt of the gun in a shooting position, although his finger was not on the trigger. That gun was pointed directly at Officer Hanneman.
Karen Wells says her son was simply protecting himself. She no longer trusts police and sees little progress on the reforms that were promised after Floyd's killing.
The saying is you have to crawl before you walk. They're not even at the stage of crawling right now when it comes to police reform. I believe that we'll get to the running stage when more police officers are held accountable for their mistakes, their lethal mistakes.
According to a Washington Post database, in 2022, police in the United States shot and killed about 1,100 people, the most since the paper began tracking fatal police shootings in 2015 after the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. But the Post found that while the number of fatal police shootings is increasing, fewer are being reported to the federal government.
There's a saying that you track what you care about.
Andrew Bautran is a data reporter for the Post's investigative team.
This just shows, as researchers have said, that the overall attempt to track police-involved shootings has failed. There are too many loopholes for police departments to not report their police-involved shootings. If they don't want to, they're not going to.
For Karen Wells, the focus remains justice for her son.
We're going to keep saying Amir Locke. Justice for Amir Locke. I won't be quiet until I get justice for my son. I will never stop speaking up for him. Never.
It's been more than 2.5 years since the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which led to calls for sweeping police reform and more accountability. What's been accomplished in that time? Thaddeus Johnson is a criminology professor at Georgia State University in Atlanta and a former Memphis police officer. Thaddeus Johnson, what has been accomplished in that time?
I think we're trending in the right direction, but we've only created a baseline for the reforms necessary to create a police force that's trustworthy and effective. I think that there's a lot of politicization. There are some obstacles. But also there's a lack of data and evidence to really know where to pinpoint reform or to do it in a very efficient way. And so the first thing we need is a database. We need more data on traffic stops, arrests, police use of force, both lethal and non-lethal. The federal government, with President Biden's executive order, he created a blueprint. But we still have a long way to go. We understand the limits of policing. We understand that it's not just the officers on the streets, that it's actually leadership, it's state laws, it's lawmakers, but we're kind of sorting these things out. And I think that's a natural progression.
You see, it's created a baseline. We just heard in the tape, the mother of Amir Locke talk very movingly about what she's gone through and how it's affected her attitude toward police and police officers, and how she's fighting for justice for her son. What's your message to her and to so many other mothers and fathers like her who've lost children to police violence?
Well, I would let her know that she's not fighting alone, even though it may feel like it. Even if we don't see state laws being passed or these big, obvious, high-magnitude changes that we may want to see, we have to understand that reform is a piecemeal approach. But you have many nonprofits, you have many prosecutors, you have many police leaders, many judges, many lawmakers who understand that we need to move forward. I mean, look, in the past couple of years, we've seen police officers held accountable criminally. That's something that we've never seen in my lifetime. And I tell everyone this, we may not see the department of police force that we want to see in our generation, but if we continue the path that we're going, generations to come, our grandkids, they will reap the benefits of what's being done now.
We also heard in the tape about the Washington Post report looking into the disparity, the number of police shootings going up, but the number of police shootings reported to the federal government going down. What's the concern about what that creates and causes?
Well, it's very concerning. Our tax dollars pay for this service. And that's the public's data. That's our data. And we shouldn't have to beg for it. It's hard to improve things when we don't even have a baseline of knowledge. And with the limited data that we have, we're almost, I don't want to say flying in the dark when it comes to creating interventions, but we don't have the data that we need to be comfortable oftentimes to make these determinations and these changes.
You taught use of force when you were an officer in Memphis. Does that training have to change in order
for the policies to match the practices?
The one thing that we taught officers were to take control of the scene. And taking control of the scene, we're teaching officers to be aggressive. We're teaching officers to exert their physical and legal authority on the scene, as opposed to dealing with our citizens like human beings, in which they are, as if they're co-producers for solutions of crime, or people who are actually going through some type of struggle. We have to also train our officers to de-escalate, not just verbally, but also put space between officers and the people that they encounter, particularly when you can tell and look at the cues that things are escalating. And one reason that you see officers tend to be overly assertive when it comes to these aspects is the emphasis of arrests, traffic stops, and custodial stops in the evaluation process. I mean, it's difficult to be promoted. It's difficult to get a more prestigious assignment or get a better shift in a better neighborhood if you don't have high numbers in these areas. But many of these things don't have public safety value. And what they do, they tend to unnecessarily put police and citizens in adversarial situations that could have otherwise been prevented. And we also reward officers for these traditional antiquated crime fighting metrics only. We also prevent the pipeline for more diverse leaders, whether it's younger leaders, whether it's women leaders, or whether it's non-white leaders, who research has shown has been attracted to this type of policing as opposed to the warrior style policing that we've seen far too long.
Thaddeus Johnson from Georgia State University, thank you very much.
No, thank you for having me.
Last year, Raven Chacon became the first Native American composer to win the Pulitzer Prize for music, bringing new attention to a composer known for his experimental sounds and explorations of place and history. Jeffrey Brown has this story, the second of our pieces on contemporary Native art for our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
They're setting a church in Milwaukee at Thanksgiving. Large organ and musicians positioned throughout the congregation. Titled Voiceless Mass, it was conceived as a liturgical mass, but with a difference. Instead of a choir, there's an absence, the native voices long silenced by the Catholic Church. The piece was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 2022, cited for evoking, quote, the weight of history. For composer Raven Chacon, it's an example of the idea of hojon from the Navajo Diné language.
That idea of hojon means maybe things lining up with other things. Maybe it's ourselves and our position here in the universe and us finding ourselves inside of all of this and realizing that we are in a timeline of other occurrences that happen. And for me, that's what music is. It's when you hear something line up with something else and you want to hear that again.
The 45-year-old Chacon, a member of the Navajo Nation, spent his early years on the reservation in northeastern Arizona before moving with his family to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he later picked up the guitar and other instruments, including electronic. He now lives in the Hudson Valley of New York with his wife, Candace Hopkins, executive director of Forge Project, a contemporary Native-led arts organization. Chacon is a collector and creator of sounds, constantly experimenting, expanding what music can be. Writes for traditional instruments, but has them played in unusual ways or places. He also composes for very different kinds of instruments. Here, foghorns, in a piece performed by ship's crews in Bergen, Norway. And another titled Report, written for different kinds of firearms.
They're all sounds, but they all have other meanings. Of course, you know, you wonder what is on those ships? What are those ships bringing? Where are those ships from? How long are they going to stay? Same with the guns. Who's holding the guns? Why are they firing? Where are they firing these weapons? Are they weapons or are they tools? that's the hope, is that somebody hears something inside of that, whether that's a story or an emotion.
The connection to the history of a specific place is often important to Chacon, as seen here in a piece performed on Alcatraz Island, the former prison and site of a Native occupation starting in 1969. Sometimes he conveys meaning in very direct ways, as in a work titled Three Songs. Three women singing in their indigenous languages, each standing in the original homeland of her ancestors, from where they were displaced, hitting a snare drum, the symbol of the U.S. Army.
So music is sound, broadly defined, with meaning?
It can have meaning. It can tell story. It can relay a lot of information. I think we go into musical situations wanting to be uplifted, no matter what that music is. But if something else can happen, I mean, if the piece can relay history, a history that's not spoken enough, then that surely is a beautiful thing. And so a composer should try to find all the tactics of being able to let that be expressed.
So you're writing for bird whistle?
Yeah, for bird call.
Bird call.
Yep. This will be one of the, this will be this line here, this little da-da-da-da.
Chacon does this visually as well. He uses traditional notation, but also makes his own graphic scores. And these, like videos of his work, have found their way into museum exhibitions, including the prestigious Whitney Biennial. Chacon has also been concerned to bring the world of sound and music to a new generation not otherwise exposed to it. Since 2004, he's mentored more than 300 Native youth, helping them compose their own quartets. It's all part of a whole.
If I ask you, as I'm sure you've been asked before, do you see yourself as an indigenous composer? Is that how you think of yourself?
I don't know what an indigenous composer is. There's actually not that many of us out there. So maybe someday, you know, there'll be hundreds, and maybe it becomes some kind of genre. Mm-hmm. But it's a label I'm not always, I have to really think about it before using that label, because people have a lot of assumptions. At the same time, I want people to understand that even though there's only a few of us, there are indigenous people working in this medium, in classical music, chamber music, sound.
With the Pulitzer Prize, more people do now know. Chacon says he next hopes to write a work for full orchestra. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in New York's Hudson Valley.
That is fascinating. He's expanding the idea of what we consider music. You can find it among harmonizing cruise ships in a harbor, apparently.
I love the foghorns. And yeah. The idea, it's a timeline. People will build upon it.
Yeah,
great story. Great story. Remember, there's a lot more online at pbs.org/newshour, including a story about how the significant changes to the new U.S. House rules will affect the chamber this session.
And join us again here tomorrow night, where we'll explore what's led to a dramatic drop in cancer deaths over the last 30 years. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.